In June, President Obama announced that he would be sending up to 300 U.S. military advisors to Iraq and that he was positioning American resources to, quote, be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when the situation on the ground requires it. Is the United States being pulled back into the Iraq conflict? 11 years after President Bush appeared on the USS Abraham Lincoln with a mission accomplished banner behind him? In a new PBS Frontline documentary that airs tonight at 10, filmmaker Michael Kirk looks at all the things that went wrong in Iraq and what's happening now. It's called Losing Iraq, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Kirk back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
How widespread is the view that Iraq has been totally lost or maybe nearly lost?
Well, it's been such a series of missteps along the way, misjudgments, even mendacity, that now the latest news, the things that have happened since June and really May, would lead one to believe that it has slipped certainly out of the American grasp and maybe out of Nouri al-Maliki's grasp and maybe into the grasp of others, and that the future doesn't bode very well for what's about to happen there and in the region itself.
But your film suggests that it was lost pretty much from the start, within weeks of the end of the initial fighting. Does anybody other than Dick Cheney perhaps still contend that the Iraq war was a success?
I can't believe that even Dick Cheney does. I know he does, but that seems so against all known facts and knowledge. Our revisiting of every moment that seems to matter from the moment that the Saddam Hussein statue is such a difficult thing for Iraqis to pull down, all the way to the latest moments with ISIS. It would be very, very, very hard, as you lay out the chronicle, as we've done, to ever say that we were ever in control of that place.
What would it mean for Iraq to be lost? That American goals haven't been met? That Iraq is now a failed state?
It's certainly a failed state. I think it has many, many meanings. It's certainly lost to us. It was probably always lost to us, and maybe it was never ours to lose. It's also lost to the people who had aspirations for a kind of a coalition Kurd, Sunni, Shia, a place, a democracy certainly seems lost. A caliphate seems in play, but probably lost. It's the forces are so not only roiling, but almost insurmountable that it's a wonder that that all of this took 3 years after, 2.5 years after we left, to actually start to happen the way that it is happening now.
Polls last year showed little American support for involvement in Syria. Has there been any polling on President Obama's plans in Iraq?
I haven't seen any, Leonard, although I can imagine. I've seen a Pew polls and a few things, but I haven't seen anything that feels, really definitive, because I'm not sure people really understand yet. Hopefully our film will help them understand the dimensions of what is actually happening there now and has been happening since the U.S. left. I didn't, as many films as I've made about Iraq and all, I didn't really understand the degree to which it was slipping over and into a completely other place until I started to pay attention this spring and early summer.
My guest is Michael Kirk, whose latest film for PBS Frontline is Losing Iraq, and it premieres tonight at 10 p.m. on Channel 13 here in New York. Is there a prevailing by the way, this is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is there a prevailing view about what the single biggest mistake was that the United States made?
It's a fascinating problem. We love, in journalism, we love to do it. Filmmaking, we love to do it. Maybe as individuals, we love to say, well, it was this problem. It was this moment. It was the day Paul Bremer announced what's known as CPA number one, the disbanding of the political party, the Baathists, or the disbanding of the army 7 days later. In truth, Leonard, I think when you go back and do what we did, which is piece together bits of our old film and make old films and make 40 new minutes, filling in some of the gaps here and there, we looked at it and you lean back and you just say, oh my God, so many mistakes, so many misjudgments, that it's hard to say which one is the most important one. But in almost every case, the people we talk to, who are many, many of the primary sources in this story, they're just completely unaware of the implications of what they're doing as they're doing it, and it all finds itself landing at the feet of Barack Obama now, who I think hoped it was all in the rearview mirror when we pulled out in 2011 and his campaign promise was fulfilled, and I think now worries at the White House desperately about whether this war is part of his legacy as well.
Well, you mentioned Paul Bremer's Coalition Provisional Authority Order Number 1, debathification, but on the first day, he suggested shooting looters. Shouldn't red flags have gone up even then about the quality of his leadership? If soldiers had carried out Bremer's suggestion, wouldn't that have constituted a war crime?
Well, I'm not here to judge war crimes, but I know that the soldiers wouldn't do it for precisely those reasons. We talked to H.R. McMaster, Colonel McMaster, who said, that there's nothing in our code that would have allowed us to shoot people for taking computers out of ministries. That's not what we're there to do. They were never going to follow that order. I think that was a wake-up call for Bremer, too. And it's sort of astonishing when you see it in the film that an American, in effect, viceroy sent there on his very first day, sent there largely by the civilians at the Pentagon and by the people from Dick Cheney's office, that he would even say such a thing out loud is amazing. And when I interviewed him, for him to say, the mistake I made was saying it out loud so that it could get to the press, not the mistake I made was saying such an outrageous thing out loud at all.
Journalist Rajiv Chandrasekharan says that Bremer was the right kind of conservative. What does that mean? He'd been managing director of Kissinger and Associates, but he really, his background was in business, wasn't it?
Well, he was a diplomat. He certainly, as a managing director of Kissinger and Associates, had a finger in a lot of the pies that the Kissinger Associates do, and certainly adhered to the realpolitik and the geopolitical scheme of Henry Kissinger. But I think the thing that recommended him to Paul Wolfowitz and Scooter Libby, and therefore that was recommended to Rumsfeld and then to President Bush about Bremer, was that he's very much a member of the old school. Remember when we all worried some about the people who were members of the Trilateral Commission? It's that kind of a group think that, was pervasive. It's a kind of he had no experience in the Middle East, didn't speak Arabic, was given a kind of 2-week crash course and sent in there to where, when he lands, he's driving in the car and he wonders why all the buildings are on fire, and no one had bothered to tell him there was no fire department or police department operating in Baghdad at the time, and if a building caught on fire, it just had to burn itself out. I think he was mightily unprepared for the task that was ahead of him, and I think Rumsfeld and others, as I think our film demonstrates, thanks to inside information and honesty from General Jack Keane about how little they were actually prepared, that is the military and the civilians at the Pentagon, for a post-war Iraq. They just didn't have any plan really in place to do anything that was going to restore order or give Bremer the slightest chance of success.
In an interview with John Burns, Bremer said, "The day before I took this job, I was a businessman. What did I know?" Well, but the military knew, and very quickly people started leaving. We have Tommy Franks and others left abruptly. Wasn't that a clue that they do understand how to make that transition? Shouldn't the problems have been more obvious to policymakers in advance?
You would sure think so, but the amount of time we spent back then and now sort of going back over what did people know and when did they know it, you know, there was not, you talk to General Jay Garner, who was hired by Rumsfeld and the Defense Department to run what was called the Office of Humanitarian Assistance after whenever the shooting was done, Garner would step into place. He said to us, you know, I had no resources. There were virtually no conversations about what to do afterwards, that there was a sort of, I think, hubristic view. There was the view that we were going to, if you'll recall the language at the time, we were going to drain the swamp. We had a secular society we were going to go into, and we were going to plant democracy, and it would firmly take seed. And you know, those things 11 years later, those statements, those ideas are just, you know, so naive compared to what we've certainly learned about one of the most sectarian environments one could imagine. It's just, it was completely, as I say, filled with misjudgments and misunderstandings and a sort of incredible, Leonard, especially when you watch the film, incredibly naive view of our power, our majesty, and our ability to make and plant our way of thinking in that part of the world.
And we were hearing about people throwing rose petals before the U.S. military. So the feeling was they were thrilled that they were getting democracy. It didn't matter that we had to secure the country of 25 million people and we were getting rid of the troops who already were there, the Iraqi military, and sending in very few American troops.
Yes, we had about 130,000 on the ground when the Thunder Runs completed, rolling into Baghdad at the end of those 3 weeks. Franks, the commanding general, basically said within about a week, "You all can plan to go home. We're going to get out of here, and we'll leave about a division behind." So that would be about 30,000 people to handle a completely broken country. In all the infrastructure of that, a country, you know, of, as you say, 25 million people, there were these divisions roaming around of American troops inside a city of 5 million, which was Baghdad, and they had no idea what to do once the looting began, which was within 48 hours, and they didn't even know where their posts were. And the Pentagon, we had generals and colonels tell us, at the Pentagon, they had no idea where any of the troops actually were. So you had American troops in the midst of chaos with virtually no leadership, and within mere weeks, all of the commanding generals up and leave. And the task of being the commanding general was handed to General Sanchez, a lieutenant general with no field command, a two-star really, who then, you know, gets promoted up but has never led anything in the midst of what becomes the longest running war America's had. It's a horrible circumstance.
We've heard similar criticism of the U.S. approach in Afghanistan. Inexperienced business school grads who think you just hand businesses to private owners and everything will be okay.
It's the same with democracy, you know. The idea, if you look at Bosnia and Korea, South Korea, lots of places like that where the American presence continues, and the experts, you know, say the way to plan a democracy is you start very locally, and it grows over a generation, if it grows at all. The idea that you could come into a place where for 30 years there had been this sort of reign of terror by Saddam Hussein, where the Baathists, the Sunni minority, had dominated the Shiite majority, run the government in a certain way, but that somehow we would remove all of that, send what Bremer thought he was doing was send a message to the people of Iraq that the evil vestiges of Saddam Hussein would no longer be here, his army wouldn't be here, his bureaucrats wouldn't be here, and we will plant a democracy. Rumsfeld kept saying to Bremer as early as 5 months after the invasion was successful, when are we going to get out of here? When are we going to get a democracy and get out of here? As if you could have a national election and somehow someone would emerge who would be George Washington. And it just never turned out to be the case, because as they're learning in places like Bosnia and other places in the world where we've imposed our will, to the extent that it's been a success, it's been a long-term process of growing democracies village by village, city by city, region by region.
I'm talking with Michael Kirk, whose documentary Losing Iraq will be broadcast tonight at 10 p.m. as part of the PBS Frontline series. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Michael Kirk, whose latest documentary for the PBS Frontline series is Losing Iraq. It airs tonight at 10 p.m. How soon after Saddam's fall did evidence of an insurgency or violent opposition to the U.S. begin to emerge?
Well, almost right away. In a way, it depends on the definition of insurgency. But you could say, one person in our film said that within 72 hours of Paul Bremer issuing CPA Order Number 2, which was the disbanding of the Iraqi military, the way the story goes, 100,000 at least troopers went home, Iraqi soldiers went home with their weapons, keys to the ammunition dumps, and a grudge against the United States of America. And within 72 hours, the first car bomb went off, killing two American soldiers in a Humvee. And that was the beginning of that. By August, so that's in May, by August, it was full-blown when the U.N., embassy there, or mission there, was blown up, as was the Jordanian embassy and a few police stations, all sort of simultaneously. That's when the world and even Don Rumsfeld decided that they were not just dead enders chipping away at us. There was something big going on there.
Anthony Cordesman, who's not a liberal, says in your film, we were in a state of denial. When he says we, did he include himself? And what was the denial?
I think the denial, I leave it to Tony to admit that it was his own denial, but I think it certainly pervaded much of Washington at the time. The idea that somehow what was happening with the insurgency, especially in those early days, was the result of our inability to prepare. Our decisions about disbanding the Baathists and disbanding the military, and our utter misunderstanding of what was happening with those IEDs and the assassinations and all of it that began to happen, the kind of this spasm of unbelievable violence over the summer and fall of 2003. Washington, meanwhile, if you listen to the president and you listen to the vice president and Dick Cheney talking, you know, about it, it was all about we're going to win. I mean, we all remember the mission accomplished banner hanging behind George Bush when he basically said it's over. But, of course, it wasn't anywhere near over. It was just beginning.
In your film, you include Donald Rumsfeld's Henny Penny, the sky is falling dismissal of critics. It was seemed witty, I guess, at the time. But it seemed to – but it's obviously such a bad read of what was going on.
It's amazing. And when you watch the film, which begins in 2003 and ends last week, you really do see, even now, a sense of the same themes. There's the theme of Washington denying what is actually going on, or not wanting to take part in it, and certainly in the early stages, the Rumsfeld, Bush, all the way until 2006 in President Bush's case, until what they call the thumping of the Democrats winning the Congress in the fall of 2006, all the way until then, not really understanding that he was not getting the straight scoop from his staff, from his generals, from the people, General Casey over there in Iraq. You watch it and you just see it happening, and from the vantage point of 2014, it doesn't make it any easier to watch. And we've kind of intentionally put in the most gruesome parts of both the insurgency and the war so that it's kind of there, and you feel it and you know it, and you see the misjudgments in light of what was actually happening, and especially now that ISIS has taken back many of the places, many Americans and Iraqis lost their lives, whatever winning means, winning those territories, Fallujah, Ramadi, Mosul, those are all in the hands of the ISIS folks now.
When Saddam Hussein was captured at the end of 2003, was the Bush administration still planning a quick exit from Iraq?
It's just remarkable how much they continued to say that until, remember, Paul Bremer was given an order in September. He had a kind of longer-range plan to plant a democracy. And Rumsfeld, especially Wolfowitz, said, we want to get out of here. They gave him an end date, which was June of 2004, and they said, we're going to be gone by then. And they really thought they were going to be gone by then. They really hoped that he would hand it over. There'd be a constitution they would have hammered out. You know, you give it to a Kurd and a Sunni and a Shiite, and you say, good luck to you guys, and you salute and you take off in June of 2004. Well, unfortunately, by May and June, the place was literally April, May, and June of 2004. It was just Iraq was on fire.
But Bush officials insisted that Iraq, and I'm quoting, was not awash in violence. Did they actually believe that?
Well, it was their version of a kind of war of words. You know, they believed that, but it's hard to imagine that it was true when you read memos and you do what we do, which is watch it as closely as possible, see what was going on, talk to the generals who were there, there were generals who were saying, no, this is not going well. We don't have any of the intelligence. Rumsfeld and others, for example, knew from the fall that there was a huge insurgency going on, but they didn't have any intelligence about who was it. So General Sanchez scooped up all over Iraq tens of thousands of young men, Shiite and Sunni, and put them in Abu Ghraib and 16 other prisons where many of them were tortured, and where the people in our film say those prisons became de facto boot camps for al-Qaeda, which was there and preparing the next stage of the insurgency. I mean, it's another case of these missteps, and as you watch them from this vantage point, you're just astonished that they happened, but you can see how it led to the descent to the place we are now.
The Abu Ghraib photos only became available in early 2004, even though they had been taken for over a year. But they didn't, even though some people might see them as a turning point, they didn't have an effect on the elections.
Well, you know, it's so funny. It's exactly right. And, of course, if you I made a film called The Torture Question during that time about Abu Ghraib and about Guantanamo and the torturers that had migrated from Guantanamo over to Abu Ghraib. And what the administration and the military did that was so effective was they would say, you know, this was just overnight at the midnight shift at Animal House, they called the people that had been involved at Abu Ghraib, the American soldiers, when in fact what we knew was that there was a, and what reporting like Dana Priest in the Washington Post and others were revealing was that it was a systematic a response to this lack of information about what was going on with the insurgency and what was going on with al-Qaeda that was creating sort of, you know, torture central, which has all been revealed now in black site prisons in Eastern Europe and other places. All of it surrounding this thirst for intelligence, while at the same time the public statements from the president and the generals who were at the Pentagon, and certainly Donald Rumsfeld, and the vice president were just the party line was in this war of words was there's nothing like this going on, and the American people were of course either convinced or not convinced around the time that George Bush ran for re-election. They changed the military approach so there wouldn't be a lot of deaths. They'd gone back onto the bases where they stayed until the election was over. But 4 days, for example, after President Bush was re-elected, was the second assault on Fallujah by the American forces, and that city was basically destroyed.
And it led to us losing the propaganda war throughout the rest of the world. There were the Abu Ghraib photographs, and then you quote one person saying that Fallujah was flattened. Dexter Filkin says it was basically destroyed, but Colonel Thomas Hammes says that it was a victory for the U.S. Could destroying a city be a victory?
Well, I think they thought it was in this sense. It was it's a longer story, but the short version is they were being goaded. See, they were living on the bases. General Casey was in charge of what was called the light footprint, which is we'll stay on our big bases and we'll only go out for 2 hours a day and we'll do some patrols and we'll make a presence, but nobody's going to get hurt. Well, what happened was the insurgents, Fallujah had become a bomb factory. They're driving the bombs into Baghdad, blowing things up, goaded him into it, wanted it to happen, I think, before the presidential election, but it didn't. He held his fire until afterwards. Who knows whether the two are related, but you can draw your own conclusions. Then, bang, we go in. We take the place down. And the idea was that it was a military victory, to be sure. We killed everybody there, and a lot of what the vice president and the president and others said was that we were by being victorious, we had stopped the insurgency, we had wiped it out. What in fact happened, and what our film talks about tonight, is the election, which was coming up in January, was boycotted by the Sunnis as a result largely of what happened in Fallujah, and they stayed home for that election. So the first big election, the Purple Finger election, where millions of Iraqis voted for the first time, was in fact a Shiite victory, largely because the Sunnis had opted out, and it gave al-Qaeda exactly the moment they wanted, which was to jump in there with the Sunnis and start the first of many attacks that proved that the American forces living on the bases as they were not going to protect the population. And that's when, you know, all hell broke loose in Iraq.
Michael Kirk's film, Losing Iraq, will be screened tonight on PBS stations as part of the PBS Frontline series. Michael, thank you so much for being on our show today. There was so much more in the film that we couldn't get to, but it is quite eye-opening.